During this past week in Sydney, and again tomorrow in Melbourne, a book will be launched about Australian political history that I think will surprise a lot of us who think we follow things closely. Many of the events and the characters will, I suspect, resonate vaguely in one's memory, but the related details certainly were a revelation to me. It chronicles the extraordinary campaign in which Australians were not only crucially involved, but the book suggests punching well above their weight in changing the agenda internationally. So what is this story? Well, it's the way the Jewish community in Australia mobilised its forces over 30 years to secure the release of Jews in the old Soviet Union so that they could emigrate primarily to Israel, but above all to have freedom of movement. Ultimately, 1 million Jews moved to Israel from the late 1980s and beyond, significantly changing Israeli politics, but for years the USSR had banned their exit. Another clear yield of this determined campaign is the birth of one of the influential forces in our politics, the so-called Jewish lobby. One of Australia's veteran journalists, Sam Lipsky, has collaborated with Dr. Susan Rutland, a noted academic, to produce Let My People Go, The Untold Story of Australia and the Soviet Jews. And he joined me in the Melbourne studios.
Thank you, Geraldine. Good to be here.
You say that the Australian side of this story about the liberation of Soviet Jewry has not been given proper credit and that it is an inspiring and interesting aspect of 20th century Australian political history during the Cold War. Why do you think it got ignored?
I think because it wasn't at the head of the agenda for the governments that got involved. It was very much at the head of the agenda for the Jewish community and, in the end, of course, for Soviet Jewry. But because it was seen to be, at the time, just another chapter, in some cases probably just another footnote, to what Australia was doing in terms of its priorities. Remember, during the 60s, Australia was at war in Vietnam. Our focus was on Asia. Whatever was happening between Australia and the Soviet Union, though it was part of the wider Cold War, wasn't given the coverage at the time, and in some cases, I think those involved didn't particularly want the coverage. That is, not that there was a clandestine element, but that there was a sensitive side to all of the lobbying and the concern that Australia's Jewish community had to make sure that this was done in the right way, because it was so sensitive.
Why was it so sensitive?
It was sensitive because Australia was a minor player in the Cold War. Australia was not the United States. It wasn't a European nation. We sometimes speak about Australia as a middle power. In terms of its relationship to the Soviet Union, it was probably even less than that. We didn't have very significant trade or economic or other relationships with the Soviet Union. So that for Australia to take a leadership role as it did in the early 60s was putting it out there in ways in which I think the political leadership of Australia, like Menzies, Garfield, Barwick, and then later on other prime ministers, found themselves at loggerheads with the Department of External Affairs and, as it later became, Foreign Affairs, who had a rather different view and wanted an even lower profile for Australia on these matters.
Now, I'm going to come to some of those characters one by one. Reading it made me, I thought, my goodness, I can see how the Jewish lobby came into being, this very powerful entity that is really, I think, affected our politics and for quite some time. Do you agree?
I may not agree with how powerful the Jewish lobby is, because sometimes I think the Jewish lobby wishes it was a bit more powerful and influential, but I think that is a perception. What is certainly true is that the campaign for Soviet Jewry provided the training ground for one, even two generations of Australian Jewish leaders and for the community itself to understand how, as a minority, it could nevertheless be part of the whole democratic process, how it could relate not just to government, but to the media and to the wider arena of public opinion. It was the training ground. Mm. And the reason it was the training ground was that most people, I think, when they think and hear the term Jewish lobby, they immediately think of Israel. But in fact, Soviet Jewry provided a kind of uniting force across left, right, centre for Australia's politicians. That is, it didn't matter whether it was the Labour Party or the Liberal Party. They were able to take this up as a human rights issue. It didn't have the political overtones that, of course, the Israel-Palestinian issue has.
Mm.
And therefore, it was, I think, more readily available to the Jewish community as that training ground, as the way in which the community learnt about how to demonstrate. What do you do when you organise a demonstration? How do you send a freedom bus to Canberra? What do you do when you write to politicians? These might seem today, I mean 50 years later, obvious, but they weren't at the time. And bear in mind that at the time the Jewish community was a relatively new community in Australia, most of which had been immigrants who had just come here after the Holocaust and World War II and were just beginning to learn how to relate to Australia,
well,
how to be part of the scene.
Yes, and they were learning to wield influence. And you start in your book with this extraordinary event of May the 17th, 1988. It's 27 years next week to the week when 3,000 Australian Jews gathered at the Melbourne Arts Centre to welcome 15 former Soviet refuseniks who'd been effectively lobbied, who'd been released, and who there was extraordinary elation and tears. And Prime Minister Bob Hawke, known to be this incredible supporter of Israel through his big friendships with the key Jewish businessmen, punctured the mood. Now, it's quite a tale. I'll read what he said. So he did the usual expectation of celebration, and then came the surprise. This is what he said. The Palestinian in the occupied territories, as the Jew in the Soviet Union and the black in South Africa, has his aspirations to be truly free. The friends of Israel around the world are fearful that, in a real sense, we may be witnessing again, after thousands of years, a giant, eyeless in Gaza. Is there not emerging the danger of Israel being blinded to the threat to its very soul and the vision of its founders? And a giant shock descended, Sam.
It did. I was there, and I remember it vividly to this day. The reason I wanted the book to open with that, because I thought it focused on the two central characters, if there are characters. This is not a novel, this is history, but the two central characters in the book really are Izzy Liebler, the longtime leader of the Australian Jewish community, who worked so closely with Bob Hawke politically, professionally, in business, but also created a very strong personal bond. And then Hawke, who had been the champion not just on Israel, who had developed his own personal relationship with Golda Meir and other Israeli leaders, comes to this incredible, very emotional event and uses the occasion deliberately, chose his words carefully, and of course, as we say in the book, sent shockwaves. I think in the perspective of history, we don't want to exaggerate it, because if I think of Bob Hawke and Soviet Jewry, I think of him as the great Australian champion who, at one stage of his life, as he says in his own memoirs, even contemplated taking his life, committing suicide, as
yes,
it were.
Yes, I've never heard this before. That's in his memoirs, is it?
Yes, he speaks of it himself. In our book, we try to give the actual background, which creates the whole environment in which this series of events in which Bob Hawke was in Moscow, the relationship, the personal relationship he had with the refuseniks, and his relationship with the highest levels of the Kremlin and the Soviet government at the time, led him to believe that he had had this magnificent breakthrough and that some of the refuseniks at his request would be released. Well, the KGB and the Politburo conned Bob Hawke. They had their reasons, who knows, at the time. And Bob Hawke felt that he, in his despair, had not only let the refuseniks down, but that he had let himself down, and that, you know, this was something that he, well, he later did something about it magnificently by negotiating with Gorbachev and getting the release of five of the refuseniks.
But this is what makes this amazing statement, which he pondered carefully. It was very deliberate. It was scripted. There was nothing improvised about it. He wanted to send a message to the Israeli, to the Jewish community in Australia. It's incredible.
It is incredible in a way. And then 20 years later, when I interviewed him in his Sydney office, we went through all this again, and I wanted to be sure that it wasn't some speechwriter, it wasn't some advisor. No, he had chosen the occasion. It was deliberate. And as he said, I did want to send a message. I knew what I was doing, and I did what I did because he wanted to alert, as he saw it, his friends who were pro-Israel. He himself regards himself to this day as pro-Israel, but had become very disillusioned with what he saw to be the direction of the then Israeli government.
Now, look, just because I'm aware of time, Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser was there that night, as was John Howard. It was an incredible night.
It was an incredible night. Just to make the point, John Howard was certainly there, but Malcolm Fraser was in the Australian embassy in Moscow.
It was
one of those weird coincidences where a former prime minister and a future prime minister were linked on the same evening in Melbourne. And yes, Malcolm Fraser had played a very significant role himself in bringing the influence of Australia to bear on the issue of the refusniks of the Jews in the Soviet Union.
And again, just relatively briefly, the role of people like Garfield Barwick and Whitlam and former Senator John Wheeldon, all of these really big characters of Australian political life, they were all drawn into this, weren't they?
They all were. And I want to say a word in particular about Sir Garfield Barwick, because as I say in the book, in some ways, we don't have any evidence that he really understood the significance at the time, and in retrospect, what we now know to be probably the most important role that Australia played historically, which was Australia was the very first nation anywhere to raise the issue of the plight of Soviet Jewry at the United Nations. And it was 2 years before the United States ever got around to raising the issue.
1962, wasn't it?
Yes, Australia raised the issue in the United Nations 5 days after the resolution of the Great Cuba Missile Crisis. It was a very tense time in the Cold War, and yet Barwick insisted, against the advice of his diplomats, that Australia should raise the issue, and he persisted with this, and indeed, until he went to the High Court, when Menzies appointed him Chief Justice, Barwick repeatedly instructed the Australian ambassador and the Australian delegates at the United Nations to keep pushing the issue. And there's no mention of it in any of the biographies. There's no mention of it in his own memoirs. For him, it was just another day at the office. But in terms of the history, when it is written of Australia, the Soviet Union, Soviet Jewry, and certainly the Australian Jewish community, this is one of those epic moments which I think is worth a book.
Thank you, Sam Lipsky, for joining us.
And thank you, Geraldine.
I'm Geraldine Doogue. Thank you for your company. I'll be back at the same time next week. And remember, you can find out more about this and all our fabulous programs on RN via our website.